Welcome to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, the show designed to help make middle age your prime time of life by defying the notion that once you reach 40, 50, or even 60 years old, your crowning achievements are all behind you. Regardless of whether you're just approaching 40 or are firmly entrenched in your middle years, it's time to launch your very own personal journey toward a joyful and purpose-filled second half of life. Each week, host Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, will discuss the challenges common to middle age and help guide you to a brighter tomorrow. Now, here's Roy.
Well, today we return to the subject of marriage, specifically long-established marriages at middle age. And here are five thought-provoking questions for you to consider. After all these years, is your spouse still your best friend? Do you share your innermost thoughts and emotions with your spouse, or do you hold certain things back? Are you two still in a 50-50 shared life partnership? Do you do your fair share around the house and in spending time and disciplining the kids? Does your spouse do his or her fair share? The third question, would your spouse's life be more or less fulfilling were you not around? Fourth question, do you really know who your spouse is today, what he or she wants out of life, and what makes him or her happy, and what he or she expects from and wants out of you? And the fifth and final question, at least once a week, are the two of you intimate as man and wife, or are you strictly mom and dad to the kids and best of friends? Do you still go out on romantic dates at least once or twice a month? And are these dates adventurous, fun-filled, and fulfilling for both of you? And if you didn't answer yes to all five questions, then your midlife marriage probably is not all that it can be. You know, there are couples our age who look, feel, and act like newlyweds after 20 or 30 years of marriage. Even if you answered yes to all five questions, would your spouse give the same positive responses if he or she took the quiz? You and I both know that a marriage never really works out over time unless both husband and wife are fully satisfied. And if you did not answer yes to all five questions and really mean it, then you've tuned into the right program. You know, in the introduction to their book, our guests today cite the old country song by Johnny and June Carter Cash. We got married in a fever hotter than a pepper sprout. We've been talking about Jackson ever since the fire went out. And our guests today are here to tell us how to relight that fire. And they've interviewed happily married couples in all 50 U.S. states and in 48 countries and all seven continents. And yes, that includes Antarctica. Maybe they found some happily married penguins down there. I don't know. Doctors Elizabeth and Charles Schmitz are considered America's number one love and marriage experts. And they're sometimes called the G-rated Masters and Johnson, and they are authors of the best-selling award-winning book, Building a Love That Lasts, The Seven Surprising Secrets to a Successful Marriage. And they're here to share insights gained from interviewing couples who have been married from 30 to 77 years. That's pretty impressive, isn't it? Hello, Doctors Liz and Charles, and welcome to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age.
Oh, we're glad to be here, Roy.
Glad to be here, Roy.
And you sure tackled the right questions right up front with your viewers or your audience. Those are really top-notch questions that get at the heart of what marriage is all about and what we've heard from these great couples around the world.
Yeah, and for all of us who would like to repair a stagnant or crumbling marriage or convert a good one to a great one, please give us at least a few of the seven secrets you found in those successful marriages around the world.
Well, the really cool thing about it, Roy, is that when we first started this out 31 years ago, we didn't really know what we were going to find out there when we started interviewing these couples. And what began to be clear in the first few years was we're hearing a lot of the same thing in different parts of the United States. So we said, well, let's expand that notion. So we started going and traveling in foreign countries and interviewing people, and we started hearing the same thing. The same thing we heard in the U.S., we were hearing in Europe and in Asia and South America and so forth. And what we discovered, it might be a better word, is that there are some pervasive characteristics that are present in successful marriages, irrespective of culture, continent, you know, location, ethnicity, that the things that make the best marriages great are pretty dang consistent throughout the world. And so we said, we ought to tell people about this. You know, we ought to say, look, here's what we found. You can emulate it. You can learn from it. You can be educated by it. And when your relationships get stagnant or in some cases boring, or you begin to wonder after 30 years if this is a person you want to stay with, there are ways to renew that, to rediscover, to rekindle, if you will, all of those wonderful things about each other that you love for so long.
Yeah.
And so these seven pervasive characteristics are really the starting point for building great marriages.
And what are a few of these, just to give us some ideas of what really works in marriages?
Absolutely. And the first one you really alluded to in your five questions when you started the whole conversation today, and that's the togetherness. That the two become one without losing their individual identities, that they form this bond of we. It's not you, it's not I, it's this we concept of we can do this together, we talk about our goals, we know what each of us wants, but we also know what we want together out of life. And how we make that happen is a planned event. It's a planned strategy that the two come up with as they work together, and they always think about the couplehood, the concept of making it in life together. It's that old adage of, while all the world is going crazy around you, the two of you have this bond and this togetherness that holds that relationship tight.
Yeah, I know you talk about, use the example of couples dancing, and it brought to mind this charming Chinese-American couple that my wife and I met on a cruise last December, and they were probably in their 50s or so, but they were dancing really cool out on the dance floor, and just the way they coordinated together, you could tell they were very much in love. And then when we met them later and talked to them, obviously that affirmed that they had great affection for each other. But, you know, they were individuals, and yet they were together as a couple so clearly out on the dance floor that...
And that's a great metaphor for the kind of love, and you hit on it earlier. When we were in Buenos Aires, you know, they like to tango.
Yeah.
You see them tangoing in the streets and so forth. And the first thing that occurs to you after watching them for just a few minutes is a tango is something you can't do by yourself.
No, that's right. Unlike these rock and roll dances. Sometimes
the physics of it just won't allow it. You know, they're spinning and turning and dipping and diving and all of this sort of stuff. And then you get it. You say, that's really sort of like life. That's like marriage. You need each other. You work together. You coordinate your functions. But you stay individuals. You don't become clones of each other. Oh, yeah, you become probably more alike over time. But you don't lose your individual identity. You don't lose your hobbies. You don't lose the things that you feel inside. And so being an individual as part of a loving relationship is actually an ideal thing. It says that I can be me, but I can also submerge myself into this twosome.
I noticed in your marriage quiz that the couples you interviewed didn't say that you should lose your individuality and just become a couple strictly without maintaining that individuality and fitting the two unique strengths and weaknesses together to form a great union.
And Roy, that's one of the things that I was so impressed with, especially in these great marriages when you hear them. The man really has strengthened and supported his wife, and vice versa. But there's a strength in the wife of her own character and knowing what she wants to do, and absolutely crediting her husband for giving her the strength and support and the real passion for being able to allow her to grow. She hasn't been relegated to a second-class citizen.
Yep.
Yes, that's the thing I constantly have to work on in my marriage. I'm so wrapped up in this program and other things, the books I've wrote and other things I've done. But I have to be conscious at all times that I want my wife to grow and pursue her desires and grow as a person and enjoy her life just as much as I'm enjoying mine, or it really doesn't work that well. If just one person is growing and the other is strictly the, like they say, the wind beneath the wings is fine, but you have to have your own goals and objectives as well.
Absolutely. No, there's no question about that whatsoever. You know, we could touch on another one here, Roy, that got reinforced for us about 2 weeks ago. Yeah. We were in Auckland, New Zealand, and we interviewed two couples that have both been married for 60 years.
Wow.
And it was just breathtaking. But here's what was so cool about it. We interviewed them, and then we heard, of course, the same things we always hear. And then we interviewed the other one, and then they were telling us the same thing. Their advice for a successful marriage was the same. And again, that doesn't surprise us, but they really reinforce what we know to be so true. And I'll use the word true because being truthful, being honest, building a relationship of trust is the most critical thing that a couple can do within their relationship. These two couples, like others around the world, said the most important part of a marriage, if you will, the heart of a marriage, the core of a marriage, is trust. And you don't develop trust by being untruthful, by telling a lot of lies or white lies, by saying doing one thing and saying something else or vice versa.
Yeah.
These couples, and you touched on it in your introduction, this notion of no sacred cows. They're willing to talk about things even when they're uncomfortable sometimes.
Yeah, and that's why affairs are so destructive, I assume, to a true and lasting marriage. I bet not many of these couples that you interviewed had affairs during their marriages.
No, and let me tell you, we are on a lot of shows, especially when some of the political folks or the celebrities have their flings and then come back and say, oh, I stand by my man garbage. And let me tell you what, it doesn't work. Soon after that, you hear about their file for divorce.
Yeah, so frequently that happens.
Oh, yeah, and it's because even if they stay together, unfortunately, the relationship instantly changes.
Yeah.
The core of that relationship can never be the same. It can be modified. It can work. But it can't be one of these glorious, great relationships that we interview, because their trust is unabiding. It is so solid. It is rock solid, and it just doesn't change.
And when you violate it, gaining it back is virtually impossible. It almost never happens. And we tell people, don't be delusional. Don't think that you can do this and it doesn't change the dynamics of stuff. And people have done this after 20, 30 years of marriage, and then they destroy everything that they work so hard to have because they think, oh, well, you know, a weak moment or I'm out of town, you know, at a convention.
Yeah,
who cares? But it matters. It matters desperately, and it kills the best relationships.
Yeah, that's very true. Well, my wife will never find out about this because I'm 500 miles away from home.
Yeah, right.
But then,
you'll know as soon as you walk in the door.
Yeah, the spouses can usually tell, I think, and that little bit of doubt enters in there, and it really changes everything. And I like the point that you make about joint finances, how that's very important. You call it filing a joint return in a chapter, and I'd never thought of that because I know some couples who both work like to keep their finances separate. And but you found that the happiest and most successful couples generally share their finances?
They absolutely do. And you hear them, and it comes back to that concept of the we, the togetherness, and the similar goals that they talk about it. They decide what they're going to do and how they proceed with their goals. And it's so much a factor of we. These couples would never think to have separate accounts, that they spend their money at different things and do what they want. And, oh, it's my little pot of whatever. It's because the whole concept of that marriage is working towards similar goals and being together in what they want to do.
And I don't suspect the successful marriage is that the husband runs out and buys a Jaguar sports car without telling his wife in advance and getting some agreement on that or something like that.
Oh, not at all. And let me tell you, they have this common agreement. Again, it's about communications and talking with each other and knowing what you want to do. And these couples talk about, you know, at certain times in our marriage, Charlie and I said, you know, $20 was a big amount, and
yeah,
don't spend $20 without us talking about it. you know, and then it became, okay, $100. Spend $100, but we don't need to talk about it. So at different points in that marriage and the financial situation changes, there are certain points. A Jaguar, never going to happen, even in the best of financial situations. A Jag is going to have a conversation and thought overnight with the two of you before that's spent for.
Couples tell us all the time how many times they left a new car at the showroom floor when they slept on it, or they decided not to buy that, or they decided not to take that exotic vacation or whatever because they got together and they said, you know what, we can't afford this right now.
Yeah.
No, it's a burden we don't want to take on, and that's what the best marriages do. They talk.
Yeah, about, or we could afford this, but we'd have to give up other things that both of us want, and it really would benefit only one of us. You know, maybe the female of the house is not going to be bombing around in that Jaguar as much as her husband, so she's not really gaining much, and she's having to sacrifice things so he can have that pleasure alone.
It's so true, and that really gets down to the nitty-gritty of what it means to have that togetherness. And that open communication that Charlie was alluding to, that you talk about anything and everything. And those conversations are critical to understanding and listening for what your husband or your wife really wants out of life and what your goals are together.
You know, here's one that you mentioned, one of the seven that people don't think about that much, but surprise and unpredictability, how that strengthens a marriage, and you know, things can get so routine. How do you create the surprise and unpredictability in a marriage?
Well, we have an old saying around our house that a good marriage is like driving in a torch red Mustang convertible. You know, your hair blow and the sun is beautiful and you're out there enjoying the countryside and the like. And what that really says is, if you just want to sit in front of the television, you know, or you want to sit on your back porch and, I don't know, contemplate your navel, whatever you do, that doesn't make for very boring, that makes for pretty boring relationships.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
So the best marriages recognize that you can only, if you do that too much, you begin to lose the spark, the flame in the relationship. We see we've interviewed marriages that do some of the darndest thing to throw spark, including the 83-year-old woman, I believe her age was about 83, when her husband came to the door after playing golf, and there she was all resplendent, you know, in her birthday suit. And that sparked something certainly in him. So we hear stories like that all the time of people who say, yeah, I remember the time we did, you know. And sometimes, by golly, you just got to go on a trip. You just got to go have fun somewhere.
True.
You got to go, as you said, one woman had gotten divorced and then remarried a few years later. And then she said they had been married for about 32 years. Hmm. And she says, the problem with my first husband is I wanted to dance. And he would never go dancing, you know, and 30 or however many years it was, I don't remember the details now, but she wanted to dance and he didn't want to dance. And she finally said, my life is going to be about dancing. So she went to a dance club after they had gotten a divorce, and she ran into this very nice man in his 60s. They hit it off and they started dancing. And that was a twice weekly thing for them. And they ended up getting married. You know,
that's the place to go, obviously, if you like dancing, go to a dance club.
Exactly, and that's what these marriages do. They don't let their marriages get boring or stale. They're always doing something. Liz and I exhaust each other sometimes, doing something new, coming up with a new idea, traveling to a different place. But it's so much fun, and we thought we might have been kind of unique way back in the day. Turned out we weren't unique at all, that these best and most successfully married couples do have spark. It could be a joke, it could be a trip, it could be a lot of different things, but it upends the expectancies of a boring relationship.
Yeah, we met this couple in their late 80s on a couple of cruises. In fact, we saw them on two different cruises, one to Hawaii and one to Alaska, and we asked the lady if they planned the cruises together, and she said, no, my husband will just come home and tell me to pack, and he'll tell me whether to pack for warm weather or cold weather, and then he'll surprise me on where we're going. And they were another couple that were out dancing all the time in their 80s, and it was really pleasant to see.
That's the best way to be.
You know, rather than so many people settle back in their retirement home at that age and just, like you say, sit around and watch TV and complain about the world and the politicians and the weather or whatever.
And, you know, Roy, that's the amazing part about these interviews. And, you know, we feel very fortunate to be able to do this with our lives and listen to these unbelievably magnificent couples and the relationship they have with each other. It comes back to that old saying of the relationship between husband and wife trumps everything else.
Yeah.
Everything's good in a marriage if that relationship is solid. The kids are fine. Things work out. You can manage any kind of challenge if that relationship is solid. And the folks that know that instinctively and then work at it, and it takes hard work. None of these couples say it's easy. They go through all kinds of bumps and humps and lumps and turmoils, and they really do work to make sure that they're always cognizant of keeping that relationship.
Yeah, I know you point out that these couples all have gone through difficult periods in their life, sometimes losses of tragic losses, and that strengthened their marriage. And so many other marriages, you know, a loss of a child or something leads to a breakup of the marriage. But I know from my wife and I had a personal experience. Our 32-year-old daughter was a naval pilot, and then she was killed flying a banner over a San Diego Chargers football game after she'd left the Navy. And that was, of course, very traumatic for us, but we found that actually strengthened our relationship, even though obviously we were saddened and horrified by the loss of our daughter. But it certainly, you can, if you really have the right kind of marriage and the sharing relationship with your spouse, you can live through those things and get stronger.
One of the things, Roy, that there's so many folks that we talk to, and not during interviews, but just people on the street or friends or people that drop by or, you know, meet people new in the airport or something. And yeah. And they so many of them have this mistaken notion that the best marriages live in some kind of a la-la land, you know,
yeah.
that everything's hunky-dory and nothing ever goes wrong and everything's Ozzie and Harriet and, you know, and all this sort of stuff. But the truth of the matter is these great marriages, almost everyone we've interviewed have gone through some sort of trauma.
Yeah.
You mentioned a loss of a child. We went through that. You went through that. You know, people lose their jobs. People get transferred
yeah.
to a part of the country they don't want to go to. You know, on and on and on. But they, a friend dies, a cousin dies that they particularly love. Whatever the case may be, life has its ups and downs. It has its ditches and ruts. But these people, they recognize that this can strengthen their marriage if they'll just charge forward together. They'll make this work. They'll make it happen. They'll keep their marriage solid and strong. And actually,
you know what I found, kind of on a different subject, but somewhat similar. I found it surprising in the marriage quiz you have at the end of your book that I think the couples that you interviewed in general said that having children did not add to the enjoyment of their marriage, which, you know, the classic American family or anywhere family is that, you know, kids always add to the relationship and make it stronger. But how can those with kids, especially teenagers, overcome what sometimes can be an obstacle to your relationship?
Well, you remember that one quote we used in the book from the writer Nora Ephron. She said that having children is like throwing a hand grenade into a marriage.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of truth to that. You know, people think, well, our marriage is not doing so well. Let's have some kids. And
oh, yeah, that's the worst thing you can do.
Oh,
actually.
My God. And Liz really hit on it a while ago. You know, the relationship between mom and dad trumps everything. And if you don't attend to that relationship, if you don't keep it strong, then your children are going to sense that. They're going to sense that you view the world differently. They're going to sense that you have different discipline techniques, you know, et cetera. The relationship, if it's strong, if you attend to that relationship, including intimacy, when you have children, you are much better able and equipped to deal with the problems of having children. Because children, you know, and here's another thing. We have found from these successfully married couples for long term, don't think that they all run around and say, boo-hoo, I've got an empty nest. They don't. Because for many of them, and for most of them, they take it as an opportunity, another phase of life where they can go enjoy each other and meet new friends and do some other things and the like. So children are wonderful. They're great. You want them around. You love to nurture them and grow them and the like. But if you begin to think that the center of your marriage is your children and not your relationship, then you're going to have some problems down there.
Yeah, it's sad when parents become strictly mom and dad, and all the romance and excitement goes out of their marriage, and they're constantly in those roles. And like you say, when you become an empty nester, I know we talk about that a lot on this program, and also I have some chapters on that in my book. It's really an opportunity of a lifetime, not a loss, because you're really not. Just because your children are no longer at home doesn't mean they're gone out of your lives, and it gives you so much more time and energy and opportunity to pay more attention to yourself and to your spouse and to do things together that you haven't been able to do before.
Yep. You know, the wonderful thing we tell people all the time is growing old is a good thing. Because, as my mother used to say, if you don't like growing old, you can consider the alternative.
Yeah. My wife always tells me when I berate having another, dread having another birthday.
You better be dang happy you have one. I just had one on Monday. Oh. And it felt good. And you know, and here's the thing. We recently penned an article about this on one of the websites that we write for. And it basically said that there are so many people that we run into now, particularly younger people, who don't think about growing old.
No, they never do.
You know, and then the truth is, then they never think about what it must be like to grow old by yourself.
Yeah.
You know, not having an advocate, not having a friend, not having someone around, not having someone to share life with, to share resources with, to share travel and fun and all those things with. And then they wake up one day and they say, oh my God, I'm 35 years old, or I'm 40 years old, and I'm not married, and I'm growing older, and yada yada, you know.
And then they panic and enter into a foolish marriage or relationship.
Growing old by yourself is not fun. And if you, I always say to people, if you don't believe that, then go up and just hang out in the parking lot for a while of your nearby supermarket.
Yeah.
And watch the people who come in and out of their cars and go into the store and you know, and do their shopping. They're people that are by themselves, that are alone in life. There's a different demeanor about them. There's a different look about them. There's a different way they walk. It's you know, growing old by yourself is not fun.
And as you point out in your book, that going old alone, generally, you don't live as long. There's higher alcoholism and drug abuse and all kinds of negative things affect people that don't grow old with somebody else and share life with someone else.
No question, Roy. And, you know, men, to the men listening out there, getting married will, on average, add about 10 years to your life.
Yeah.
And that's an amazing statistic. But what Charlie said is absolutely what the research has shown.
That there are benefits to marriage. Women will live on average 4 years longer.
Hmm.
Women by nature live longer anyway, but but 4 years longer just by being married. And why is that? Sharing the burden, having a confidant, having a friend, having someone where you don't have to do all the work and you don't have to do all the carry all the anxiety and all that sort of stuff. There are all sorts of advantages to being married, to having someone in a relationship, and living longer is certainly one of them.
Yeah. Well, let's, in a successful marriage, I know you say we should share everything, but is it okay to hold a few things back? I'm thinking of examples like this. Say you suspect that your husband had an affair 3 years ago, but you're certain it's over now. Should you confront him with it and ask him to come clean?
No, absolutely not. They should have had the conversation at the time the suspicion was there and the things were going on, et cetera, to have it 3 years later and to hold that grudge and to keep that going is not going to serve any useful purpose.
Well, say that I hate that my wife has gained 30 pounds since we got married. Should I tell her that she's gotten too fat?
I think I would be a little more delicate about it, but but I think it's okay. It's like that Abraham Lincoln Mary Todd commercial on television where she says, "How do I look in this dress?" And he gives that signal, "Well, you're a little too heavy for that dress," you know. And the truth of the matter is, and that's one of those things that we found in successfully married couples. They care about the health of each other.
Yeah, that's so important. You point that out, that that's one of the seven secrets to a successful marriage, is you both work on fitness and keep your appearance and be as healthy as you can, because you're really not doing your spouse a favor by letting your health go and letting your
Absolutely.
Weight go and all those kind of things.
And by the same token, when you see that your spouse is engaging in unhealthy activities and gaining weight and not exercising, and those things are eventually going to affect not only him or her, but they're going to affect you. And so you need to attend to those things, because the objective, you know, growing old is not a lot of fun if you do it in a wheelchair. Right? Or
no,
growing old is a lot less fun if you're unhealthy and dealing with illness and sickness all the time.
Yeah, and if your spouse is gaining weight, you really need to examine yourself and ask yourself whether your spouse is unhappy because of what you're doing and that maybe you're contributing to his or her overeating and. So it's really something that, you need to consider your part in it, as well as just putting all the blame. You're eating too much and, blaming him or her for it. But
Yep. That's the no sacred cows part. Those are things that you should talk about.
Yeah.
That infidelity question is always a tough one, because people have done exactly what you've said and then they never do it again, and they carry all this guilt, but they've never had the courage to bring it up with their spouse, and vice versa when the spouse knows about it. But there comes a point, there's always timing about this stuff too.
Yeah.
If you have overcome it, if you've made it work, if you have regained the trust and all those things, then why kick dead horses?
We can only start from where we are today and build on it. We can't really go back and kick a dead horse from several years ago, I guess. But that's still a difficult question of whether, if I have had an affair in the past and, long over it and very much love my spouse today, whether I should go back and tell her about it, to be totally and painfully honest, or whether that's just going to create that doubt that creeps in that's always going to be there. So it's a tough kind of decision to make, I guess.
Another part of that honesty thing, Roy, that I think is related to this, is oftentimes people say, well, talking about anything and everything means all those things you did before we had our relationship,
yeah.
Before we came together and got married. It doesn't matter. Your high school or college boyfriend or girlfriend, the things that you did is irrelevant to your relationship. That all occurred before. And going back and talking about that and resurrecting that and, was he better in bed than you and all that kind of stuff, that's silly. It's just goofy, and it ends up hurting a perfectly good relationship. Being held accountable for what we did in the past is something that a lot of us don't want to be held accountable for, particularly of a moral or a sexual sort of a nature. So
yeah.
Just move on. It's not important anymore.
Yeah, I try to, every once in a while I start talking about some old girlfriend in front of my wife, and then I realize how stupid that is and how hurtful it can be.
Yeah.
Well, here's one final question that this is always bothered. I think I know the answer to, but let's say that I, as a husband, am deathly afraid that I won't be able to perform very well in bed the next time that I'm intimate with my wife. Should I confess and share my concern, or is that somehow diminishing my manhood, or how do you handle that kind of a, or the wife that really would rather be anywhere else than what the husband wants to do that night?
Absolutely, positively discuss it, talk about it, and do it openly. And let me tell you what, there are a lot of wives in the world that will be very understanding, will help, will make it better, will ease the concern and all of it, and some of them don't even care about that level of intimacy,
yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera. And talking about it is absolutely the right way to go, and frame it in the right sense and be very open and honest. but don't do it when the kids are screaming in the house and things are going crazy.
No, that's right.
Pick a time, pick a place.
And I assume that a lot of these really strong marriages are not based primarily on sexual attraction after 35 years or whatever, that there's much more to it than that.
There's no question about it. In fact, we in our interview protocol, where we always say we can cut the wheat from the chaff, in our interview protocol, we have a lot of questions that what our friend Don Clifton of the Gallup organization, who is a mentor of ours, used to say are the ownership questions. You ask a question and you say, like, on a scale of 1 to 10 with 10 high, where would you rate yourself on this or that?
Yeah.
And one of the questions we have is, overall, in your marriage, where would you place the importance of sex in the success of your relationship or your marriage over time?
Hmm.
And in 31 years, that average has been 6.3.
Oh, wow, that's about where it should be, I think, maybe a little above average, but because obviously that's important, but it's not the sole determinant.
Exactly, and you get younger couples, they think that's all there is to it. But then they wake up 6 months after they got married, and they say, who is this guy in the bed with me? Your relationship better build beyond the sex, or it's going to go nowhere.
The more excitement you have and the more just friendship and fun things you do in life, I would think the sex would tend to come much more naturally and rather than when, you have this romantic evening all planned out and leading to the bed and all that kind of stuff scripted out in advance. That generally would tend to lead to much more tension than when, you just had a great time doing something that was really exciting and new and when you came home, you really felt like being together.
Yeah. Well, I'll just be honest. This is true confession time. One of the most annoying commercials to me on television are these Viagra commercials.
Oh, I hate those too.
Because they say, oh, the only thing that matters to these 60-year-old people is having good sex.
Yeah,
but I'm telling you.
When the time is right, and then they take hands together.
Yeah, I love the one where they sit and watch the sunset in separate bathtubs. Hell, get the same bathtub.
Well, tell people how they can obtain your book, Building a Love That Lasts. I know it's an award-winning, it's an outstanding commendations, and what I like about it is it tells stories and gives these real-life examples. It's not just a bunch of theory, and it's definitely, I know in previewing, it's something I'd very much like to read. How can they obtain your book?
Anywhere books are sold, the easiest way is go on Amazon and order it.
Yeah, and that's called Building a Love That Lasts, and it's and do you have any way that – I know you sometimes give seminars and classes and things like that. How can somebody access your work or what types of things you're involved in, get to know more about your activities?
SimpleThingsMatter.com. That's SimpleThingsMatter.com.
Okay, yeah, that's the website they should go to then, www.SimpleThingsMatter.com.
You bet.
And I think anyone that's been listening in that's been married for a long time certainly picked up some very valuable insights today, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Roy, for having us on, and we're celebrating number 47.
Well, you're a little ahead of us. We're only at like 40, something like that.
Hey, you got it made in the shade, as my dad used to say.
True. Only 10 more years till golden.
There you go. There you go.
Well, have a great day, and thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Roy.
Take good care.
Bye.
Well, we're kicking off another Major League Baseball season, so I thought maybe I'd close today's show with a baseball yarn. There was an article just recently in the Wall Street Journal about how Major League teams are more and more restricting access for the common ticket holder like you and me to the premium areas of the stadium, and it brought back to memory a story from years ago when I used to live in Southern California with my family, and we used to regularly like to go to games of what they then called the California Angels. I guess they're now the LA Angels of Anaheim or some highfalutin name, but back then they were the good old California Angels. And we used to, my family and I used to prefer seats up in the upper deck that were quite reasonably priced, and the players looked small way down there, but you had a great overall perspective of the ballpark, and they were very inexpensive, and they were right behind home plate. Now, the interesting thing was the ticket prices were the same all the way up to the very top of the stadium, down right to the edge of the upper deck. So you could, if you got a ticket to a game that wasn't real popular, somebody other than, say, the Boston Red Sox or the New York Yankees, you could get down really nice and low. But if you if it was crowded, sometimes you'd end up way near the top. Now, it so happened one time we went to a ball game, my son Jeff and I, and we were stuck way up in nosebleed section, maybe about three or four rows from the very top of the stadium. And I noticed we were in, let's say, section C1, and I noticed right next to our section was a section C2 that was practically empty all the way up and down, had just about no one in it. And so about the second or third inning, when it was obvious that nobody was going to fill all those seats, I said to my son, Jeff, why don't we move down to section C2 so that we can be closer to the field? Now, get this. This is the important thing. The prices for the seats were the same whether you were up near the top or down near the bottom. So Jeff and I walked down to about the third or fourth row, and they had a beautiful view of the stadium. And I said, this is great, you know, and the ticket price here is the same as what our tickets say. So sooner or later, here comes this grumpy old usher, and he said, let's see your ticket, please. And I said, yeah, here's our tickets. We're supposed to sit over here in C1, but these are the same price tickets, and we noticed nobody was here, so we thought we'd move down. I'm sure there's no problem with that. And he said, I'm sorry, sir. You'll have to move back to your original seats because the computer says this section is blocked off today. I asked if I could maybe talk to the computer and see why it hurt for us to sit in this new section. But the usher refused and said, no, you know, this section is blocked off. You can't sit here. So we reluctantly trudged back over to old C1 to our original seats. My point of all this is, don't let some little voice inside be that grumpy old usher, something that tells you that you're stuck in the box, the C1 box or the section you're in now, when there's all kinds of opportunities right next door in section C2. That little voice inside that says that work is a necessary evil and you can't have a good time while earning a living. How about that voice that says, my spouse and I have been married for 27 years and we have 4 kids, so there's no way we can share the love and passion we did when we were young and first married or dating. So I'll just, you know, at best we'll just get be friends the rest of our lives. How about that voice that says, well, now that my children are all teenagers, there's no way I can have a good time with them, and they don't want me in their lives anymore anyway, so I'll just tolerate them until they go off to college or whatever and have a life of their own. All that is just balderdash. There's no reason, whatever your age, that you can't have passion in your life, that you can't explore a career maybe outside your present employer, maybe with your present employer, that will pay you to have a good time. And there's no reason that you can't have a full and meaningful relationship with your teenagers. So now, you know, it's kind of like the your mind really is a vast computer, but that little voice of restriction may be conscious or it may be subconscious. That little voice that tells you I'm not good enough or things have to be this way is like some archaic old programmer that may be still using Fortran or some ancient programming language that is restricting your movement to the life that you deserve. And if you want to wake up to that new life, I would highly recommend my book, which is a comprehensive roadmap of how you move from section C1 to C2 and get around that old usher. It's called A Midlife Challenge Wake Up, and I would highly recommend it. You can find it on Amazon.com, or you can find it on our website, www.middleagerenewal.com. And if your business is like stuck in section 1 and you need a new leadership initiative to wake up your lagging business, I would recommend my business leadership book. It's called Wake Up, Captain and Crew, Restart Your Engines, Recreating and Re-Energizing Lagging Enterprises and Participants Midstream. There may be all kinds of potential for a vibrant, revitalized organization or business or not-for-profit organization right in your backyard, but you need to get rid of that old usher that's restricting your movement. And that's our show for today. Once again, the books are A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up and Wake Up Captain and Crew, Restart Your Engines by Roy C. Richards, and you can find them on Amazon.com or at our website, www.middleagerenewal.com. And please join us again next week. And next week we're going to talk with a couple that's still on their honeymoon, even though they've been married for 30 years. And thank you for joining us at Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age.
You've been listening to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, hosted by Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of both A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, and Wake Up, Captain and Crew, Restart Your Engines. You can learn more about Roy and his Middle Age Renewal Training System by visiting his website, middleagerenewal.com.